Hello, Western Wisconsin. Let's see what we're up to. Welcome to Spectrum West, everyone. I'm Al Ross. It is the 3rd of July. It's a Thursday, if you're listening on Thursday. Of course, Spectrum West repeated Friday evenings at 7 on the News and Classical Music Network. Happy to be there. Well, June has busted out all over, and now it's July's turn to do whatever it does. This is the arts, music, and culture of Western Wisconsin on Spectrum West, all rolled into an hour a week, so we don't waste much time diving in. Today, a few friends gather to remember artist and passionate participant in life, Lori Beasy. Jim Oliver's here with author Caroline Akervik, and they'll talk about her latest book about lumberjacks and river rats set in this neck of the woods. A UW-Eau Claire students-produced documentary has received some national attention at a West Coast film festival. One of the producers, J.R. Smathers, joins us a bit later in the show. We're going to begin today with news that we crashed a rehearsal the other day at the Mabel Tainter Center in Menominee. They're working on The Last 5 Years, which opens later this month, and director Amy Reese was nice enough to allow us to stay. She even provided some insights into what's happening, and there's a lot this summer at the Tainter. You'll hear Dr. Mark Pruitt in the background at the piano working with principals in the upcoming show. Pruitt is a valuable Mabel Tainter commodity, as Amy relates.
He was our music director for Jesus Christ Superstar, for Gales of November. He'll be our music director for 10 November. He's working with the Rodgers and Hammerstein show and this show the last 5 years.
So you just mentioned the Gales of November. That just left town. You have the last 5 years coming up. And give us a little bit of an idea of what that's about.
The last 5 years, it was written by Jason Robert Brown, who's a Tony Award-winning composer. He just won Tonys for The Bridges of Madison County, Best Orchestration, Best Original Score. And it's a two-person dramatic musical, just a really beautiful show about a relationship. Kathy, the one character, is reliving the relationship going backwards, and Jamie, the male character, is reliving it going forwards. And they never intersect except on their wedding day. It's a really beautiful show.
And a small cast?
Small cast, two people. Yeah, these are my fabulous actors, Kiara Carlson and Seth Barrier.
Talk about the music. I'm wondering how many people are familiar with the music of the last 5 years.
Very contemporary rock, sort of pop musical. I mean, very appealing, a lot of piano, very complicated. Dr. Mark Pruitt is probably the only person in the area who could play the piano for this score. I'm not saying that to be... it's very complicated. It's a huge responsibility. It has two cellos, a guitar, bass, violin, and a very complicated piano score.
And there is a disclaimer attached to this particular production, adult audiences preferred, because of what you were describing as the relationship that's going on between the two people and what they may say to each other?
There is a little bit of language, very, very minimal language, but I wouldn't recommend it for children. It just wouldn't hold children's attention. It's not Willy Wonka. It's a dramatic adult musical.
Okay. What's the duration? How long of a piece is it?
It's about an hour and 30 minutes.
Okay. And it's coming up on two separate weekends, which makes it convenient for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. It'll be Saturday, July 19th, and Sunday the 20th, and then Saturday the 26th, and Sunday the 27th.
Then you have a one-weekend run of an evening with Rodgers and Hammerstein. Do you say Hammerstein or Hammerstein?
I say Hammerstein.
Me too. And that's coming in early August. You know, and that's got to be a piece where every number's recognizable.
Oh, I think so. I think it will be. And we just had auditions for that. The beloved Lucy Widener is directing. And as I said before, Dr. Mark Pruitt is music director. Huge cast, a lot of beloved music. And this is in line with the things that we've done the last two summers. We did an evening with Sondheim and Friends and an evening with Gershwin. So there's been a huge turnout of people who've been wanting to audition and buy tickets already. So we're excited.
Have your summer packages been musicals? I mean, you go in trios, or is this a new deal this year?
This is a new deal this year. We used to do music. We found that people really love being outside for music in the park, understandably. So we're trying sort of, you know, not quite a repertory theater season, but more theater here in the summertime. And so far, people have been excited about it.
The Mabel Tainter is a busy place in the summer. I don't know if that's new for 2014, but, I mean, I was looking at the schedule, and then it goes even further Between the musicals, you have the Valley Gospel Choir coming. Have they been here before?
They have not been here before, but we're thrilled to have them. They're normally performing out of Eau Claire, but there are several members who are from the Menominee area, so it'll be exciting to have them here in town.
Talk about Friday, July 25th, Heather Lynn with Ben Johnson.
Heather Lynn is a wonderful singer-songwriter out of the Twin Cities, and she's performing with Ben Johnson. They just did a festival out by Vino in the Valley, the Rush River Music Festival. They performed here. You can hear the wonderful music in the background the last 5 years. I'm sorry, I'm distracted by that. So they are going to be a lot of fun. They're going to be performing downstairs at Cafe Mabel, something called Acoustic Night at Cafe Mabel. Similar to our Jazz and Wine at the Mabel series, but more acoustic, contemporary music. The bar's open, it's casual seating, it's a lot of fun.
So yeah, Cafe Mabel. That's pretty cool. I mean, it's a night of acoustic music, as you said. Cafe Mabel, is that kind of black boxy, or what is that?
It is kind of black boxy, and Cafe Mabel's a nice way to say the bar, actually.
Oh, okay.
Honestly, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Where I come from, cafes don't.
Yeah, we've got the bar, we have a full bar, and then we have like wood-fired pizza, and you know, some fun appetizers and things like that.
You know what I didn't ask you about is your directorial experience and career. I guess maybe I didn't know that about you. Maybe I haven't been doing my reading.
I have a degree in theater and I've been involved in theater my whole life. Was not my intention to come to the Mabel to be doing theater, but it seemed like a natural fit, and it's what we've been doing lately.
So, as things got progressively louder on stage, I asked for one quick recap of what's next.
The last 5 years runs 2 weekends only. Saturday, July 19th at 7:30 p.m., Sunday the 20th at 2 p.m., Saturday, July 26th at 7:30 p.m., and Sunday, July 27th at 2 p.m.
And you know, I have a feeling the volume was a very sneaky way of saying, hey Al, your time's up, we need to get back to work. The Tainter lineup is extensive and exciting. It's listed for the balance of 2014 and into next year at the website, which is www.mabeltainter.org. Thanks to Amy Reese and for the company of the last 5 years for putting up with my intrusion. And it appears we had a little bit of a dropout during that conversation. We apologize for that. Technology. Jim Oliver enjoys reading, and after reading many pieces, he enjoys talking with the author to create delightful segments for Spectrum West. So continuing on that theme, we're delighted to have Jim with us again today to share one such conversation.
White Pine, My Year as a Lumberjack and a River Rat, is published in March by Fire and Ice, a young adult imprint of Melange Books. The author is Caroline Akervik of Eau Claire, who joins us to talk about her writing. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for including in your biographical sketch at the end of the book a quote from C.S. Lewis, who is author of the Chronicles of Narnia series of children's books. You quoted him as saying, a children's story that can only be enjoyed by children is not a good children's story in the slightest. Made me feel better about really enjoying the book.
Thank you.
It's filled with all the elements of a good story, and that most certainly will be enjoyed by children and young adults, but holds the interest of those like me who are a bit long in the tooth. So why don't you go ahead and introduce us to the book?
Well, White Pine is a story about a young man who has to take his father's place in the Northwoods of Wisconsin as a lumberjack. And Sevi is a typical 14-year-old boy, and he wants to prove himself as a worthy man among these legendary types of characters. So that's the storyline, kind of how he faces his fears and overcomes challenges and becomes the person he really wants to be.
Where did the idea for the story come from?
Well, the idea from for the story came from going to the Chippewa Valley Museum with my kids during their third grade field trip. And we were sitting in the bunkhouse, and I looked up, and there were some, you know, old socks. They looked like stinky old socks hanging on a rail. And my son, who's named Aslan, after the lion and Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he said, Mom, why are those socks up there? And I was looking up there, and I was thinking, and the idea just kind of popped into my mind. What would happen if my son was that age, and he had to go work in this kind of environment? And so that was kind of the idea that started the story, kind of like the moment, the flash, that this is a story I wanted to write.
Now, what period in history is this set?
1880s in Eau Claire and up north of Spooner, you know, where the White Pine forests were.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of research did you have to do about the logging industry?
I did a lot of research because I'm not a native of Eau Claire, and I wasn't familiar with Midwestern like lumberjack history. I didn't know anything. I didn't even know like the parts of town, the significance, like what was the meaning of the area of Shawtown, how that was where the sawmills were. I didn't know any of that history. And I moved to Eau Claire in my 20s. And as I came to learn more about the river, you know, the significance of the rivers and how the wood came down on the rivers and just the regional history of the area, I started to kind of look into it. I started to read more, visited the museum, obviously, read a great deal. Wisconsin Historical Society has a lot of resources. There was a lot to learn. There was a lot to learn. Customs, language, you know, dialect was something I really struggled with because the logging camps were really melting pots for people from many different cultures. I really struggled as an author using correct terminology. What would one say? How would one say it in a given language? Obviously, I don't speak French, Swedish, and Norwegian. And so it was a little bit difficult. That was tough. But there was a lot to learn. And as I learned more, I wanted to learn more. And I tried to be as accurate as possible. With any fictionalization of a historical period, there might be some errors, but I did the best I could to be very accurate.
Sure. Well, probably nobody from that period is going to come back and complain.
Yeah, hopefully not.
Okay. About how long did you work on the book?
I would say, well, I'm a slow burn as an author. I usually take, with the research, it probably took me about 3 to 4 years. Mm-hmm. And then I sat on it for a while because I wasn't entirely sure it was ready to go out to publishers. And then also because it is specifically a book, it's meant for both a boy and a girl audience, but specifically I wanted to intrigue reluctant readers who tend more to be young males. And a lot of publishers struggle with publishing that kind of material because most of the reader's market in young adult now is female.
That was another area that I found interesting. Your primary character is a boy.
Yes.
How do you go as a woman? How do you go about getting into the head of a boy?
Well, I have three kids, two of whom are boys, and I have a 15-year-old boy right now. So I'm very familiar with what goes on in his head. And actually, I took him to the library several years ago, and he went upstairs. I said, "Aslan, you got to find some books, got to find something to read." And he came down and he said, "Mom, there's nothing but werewolves and vampires." And I was a little frustrated with that. And so that was another reason. I feel that we underserve, as writers, we tend to underserve the boys. We're meeting our market, which is the girl readership. And we really have to find those books. We have to make an effort to create those books mm-hmm. that can really draw young men readers, young male readers. Also, I'm a school librarian. I work with boys and girls all the time. And so I didn't find it that hard to get into my main character, Sevi's mind. You know, I think I did a pretty good job understanding how he would think and behave.
Well, she is Caroline Akervik, author of My Year as a Lumberjack and a River Rat. Well, what is a river rat?
A river rat. River rats are awesome. River rats are the guys who go down the river with the logs. You see, when you can't push the logs down the river when they're frozen, obviously. So then when the great thaw occurs and the water is high on the rivers like the Chippewa, these guys would be on rafts and on the logs riding them down the river. So this was a high risk, big time danger, exciting kind of job. They were kind of like the superheroes of the logging industry, if you will. You know, they risk their lives on a daily basis, and they're working in ice-cold water, horrible conditions. But these were the creme de la creme of the lumberjacks.
Have you written other books?
Yes, I have. Several years ago, I wrote a young adult horse story called A Horse Named Viking. And I actually have two books coming out, one, I believe, in August, which is a Christmas story. And then I have a nonfiction coming out, I believe, in February.
Uh-huh. How hard is it to get published?
It's very challenging to get published. You have to be willing to persevere. And you have to have a reason for why you write beyond the publishing. You have to have a story you want to tell that pushes you to persevere.
Mm-hmm. You say your early adult years were spent as a professional horsewoman. Then you became an educator.
Yes.
What brought that on?
Well, I trained horses for many, many years, and then I got married and I had three kids. And I found you know, just volunteering at their schools and such, that I really enjoyed working with kids. Also, physically, working with horses every day can be a little bit tough, and I was getting a little bit longer in the tooth myself, and so it seemed a good time to make a little bit of a transition. And actually, training horses and working with kids are kind of similar. So, you know, you have many of the same – you have to have patience. You have to see the big picture and not focus on the minutiae, and it's ultimately very satisfying and rewarding both. So I think there are a lot of parallels.
Do you still ride?
Not much anymore, no. Uh-huh.
Going back a little bit to the business about getting published, is there an advantage to being a librarian in getting your books published?
Well, I think with this book specifically, yes. Because this book, as I've said, it's aimed at both a male and female audience, but I wanted to engage male readers specifically. That's a harder market right now because the publishing industry is focused on the girls. You know, they're the ones who are interested in Twilight, the girls who are interested in Divergent series. That's the big market area. And so actually, I had to do a lot of research and a lot of soul searching in order to convince the publisher that a book that was directed at boys deserved its own time and space also. And the other thing I've come to realize, I've been writing for several years now, is that I have to believe in the integrity of my own story. And if a publisher doesn't see that, then maybe it's not the right fit with that publisher. Mm-hmm. So does that answer the question?
Pretty much,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I just was curious. I thought perhaps you have perhaps a better knowledge of the industry.
Well, I do understand. I understand the industry. I understand what's popular. You know, dystopia is where it's at right now. But I think that, you know, when you're writing, I think Hemingway said you have to cut yourself open and bleed all over the paper. And that's the thing. You have to find the story within you. And so it doesn't really matter so much. I don't think I write necessarily for what is popular in the market right now. I just have to write the stories that I want to tell.
So where are your books available?
They're available anywhere online. They're also at Volume 1, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. They're in both paperback and ebook.
Well, the book is White Pine, My Year as a Lumberjack and a River Rat. The author is Caroline Akrovic of Eau Claire. Caroline, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Support for WPR comes from Mayo Clinic Health System, bringing Mayo Clinic care to communities throughout western Wisconsin, dedicated to providing high-quality health care close to home. Details are at mayoclinichealthsystem.org.
Spectrum West, first edition, July 2014. Nice to have you along. Well, it's now been 12 days since this life lost the presence of Laurie Beasy, an artist, activist, entrepreneur, and business person skilled with the capacity to fashion fine, luminous pieces of art and sculpture from glass of all colors and strips of lead, but also skilled with the capacity to inspire, entertain, and accumulate friends for the purpose of simply living life to its fullest potential. Now, I didn't know Laurie personally. I had met and talked with her a few times. But after hearing more and more about how she lived, I believe, as an acknowledgement, we might coin a new verb, to Beasy. I mean, it could mean the art of taking something ordinary and turning it into something extraordinary, an event, a pile of glass, a relationship, a situation. Three of her friends, Sally Sunby, Mel Sunby, and David Caradori, gathered in our studio the other day, and I started by asking them to finish the line, Laurie Beasy was to the Western Wisconsin arts community what blank is to blank. And Mel Sunby began.
What Gertrude Stein was to Paris.
Okay. It's more like Aaron Rodgers was to the Green Bay Packers.
Okay.
Or that's, is. That's something, or yeah. Is.
Yeah. Our beer is to Milwaukee.
There you go.
People will be like looking up in the dictionary.
Who's Gertrude Stein? Yeah.
Let's not try to like.
That's not.
Although Wisconsin Public Radio has a very sophisticated
listener. He always
listener.
Tries yeah. to raise the bar.
Well, you know.
I'm getting the wide spectrum. Everybody knows who Aaron Rodgers is.
There you go.
For those who believe in the hereafter, you know, I'm guessing that people who knew Laurie will probably believe that maybe there's a glass studio somewhere on the Paradise Promenade already. Didn't take her long to get noticed, I understand.
You know, like with all artists, it's all baby steps. I think she came like in the middle to early 1970s. It is a process, and it was very gradual, but, you know, she shortly became like one of the artists in the community that brought other artists together.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's ask you all individually
how you met her. Do you remember the first time you ran into her?
I do. I met her in her gallery that she had on, I think it was Barstow Street, the one with the dragon that used to crawl down the wall.
Ah.
I met a few artists through her, and ultimately, when I came here 21 years ago, Laurie was the first artist I ever met, and she was kind of responsible for the circuit that I ultimately created or made in the Valley.
Mm-hmm.
But I have an anecdote that I like to always tell, that she was on the ECRAC Arts Board at the time. The State Theater was kind of like the Titanic at that point. It was sinking slowly into the dust. She talked to me and asked me if I'd be interested in being on that board because there was an opening.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, had been here a couple of years and thought it might be a good way to get my feet wet in the community. So I said, sure. And she said, well, next Wednesday will be the meeting, and come over to the gallery and pick me up. So I did. It was about 7 o'clock, and I walked into the gallery, and someone else was there, and I asked where Laurie had gone. She said, she went home. Well, I went over to the State Theater and went to my first meeting, and the director over there, very kind of coyly, told me that she had resigned that day. So we never got to serve on the state board together, and I've always held that against her.
So she was simply taking care of her replacement, actually.
That's exactly what it amounted to.
By asking you. Okay. Yeah. Sally, do you have a recollection?
I actually knew Laurie before Mel met her. She had had she actually had two stores down on Barstow, and it was the first one that she had that I met her and kind of struck up a relationship, friendship with her. My parents moved up here from Milwaukee and just fell in love with her work, and so I took them down there to meet her. And as soon as Mel and I got married, you know, she just was one of the first people that I wanted him to meet.
Hmm.
And she just embraced him and introduced him to the art community immediately, because that's what she was all about.
I think David was the second artist that I met in the community, too, that worked out.
Steve Batchgold, who was working at Channel 13 at the time, was doing this elaborate story about the first year I was opening my business, and he was going through the entire process of what it takes to be a potter, and he wanted to experience the full spectrum of what an artist does, from like digging the clay for me, digging the clay, making the pot, firing the kiln, and then having somebody buy it. As serendipitous as it was, Laurie Beasy was the one who walked in the store that day, probably really close to the first time that I had met her. And she was the customer that was on the story, you know, like showing somebody buy it. Ironically, I had recently found a copy of that, and I showed it to her before she died, and we got a big laugh out of it.
Any idea how she decided on glass as her medium of choice? Was she well-rounded prior to specializing?
Actually, her background is in painting. You know, it's a long story, but the glass for her, I think she saw was a more viable option to sell it in the Midwest, which is a little bit more, it's harder, I think, in my mind, it's harder to sell paintings than just about anything around here.
Mm-hmm.
And glass, you know, it's kind of like with pottery, it's more strictly functional. People can order it, they can customize it and stuff. And when she started the studio, we'd often talked about, like, how to make a living and, you know, satisfy your soul and yet make a living at it. Her background is in design, too, so I think it was shortly after that she started to open up the studio with her husband, Dennis Beasy, at the time.
Okay. In the studio with us, Mel and Sally Sundby and David Caradori. We're talking about the passing and the life of Laurie Beasy. We frequently, on this program and within our neighborhoods, we talk about the term arts community, and there really is an arts community in western Wisconsin broadly. Contrary to the occasional suggestion that it's an exclusive club available only to an elite few, this really is a community that needs participation from everyone. Talk a little bit about the arts community of which you feel you're a member.
I was a teacher for 30 years, a college instructor. So a lot of the students that came at me were brand new. You know, they were between, you know, high school and probably 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Over 30 years, the way I was teaching my classes and how to appreciate the business of art was through the appreciation of art history, number one, to show the reflections of man's behavior or their psyche, if you want to call it that, which art has oft been equated to. Then I also taught them techniques of five or six different concepts as far as painting and pottery and things of that nature. I've always said that an artist, before he can be called an artist, and I think that's true in any field really, a good speaker needs to learn his voice, and he needs to learn some aspects about the subject that he's going to be talking about. The community here has been growing on a regular basis in the last 22 years since I've been here. I've seen it. It's really quite magical. And it certainly isn't that it's isolated, because we have Milwaukee and Chicago, you know, just a few hours from here, in Minneapolis, which is an art center as well. But I think theater, music, visual arts, all of it, you know, that there is an arts community, it's becoming recognized. You know, guys, the caliber of Laurie and David, I was thinking in particular because mm-hmm. he's sitting here, but these people have exhibited all over the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are pretty good-sized names. They've made a good life as an artist.
I moved here 24 years ago. It's really surprised me the breadth of the artistic community in western Wisconsin, mm-hmm. having grown up in eastern Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I was pretty proud of that area, but man, this place... you know, doesn't take a second seat to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I lived in Milwaukee for about 10 years mm-hmm. before I came here as well. And you're right. It was a broad-based arts program in Milwaukee, but it wasn't too well known outside of it.
Here in western Wisconsin, Eau Claire appears as the hub, but it seems as if every small town has something going on. Mm-hmm. People who live out in the hinterland with their studios, there's a small theater in almost every small town in western and northwest Wisconsin. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, one of the most valuable things that Laurie contributed as far as the art community is she brought a lot of artists together. She would have these elaborate parties at her house, and she brought together many circles of people. Mm-hmm. And that's so valuable because art, you know, it's more of an advocation, and we need the fellowship of our fellow artists to, you know, to thrive and to, because it's a tough business. I've been doing it for 28 years, and we need support from not only our friends and the community, but... you know, Laurie, you know, for many years, I really feel that she was just the compass. She brought so many people together. I know so many different people because of Laurie in the arts, and not just like the two-dimensional, but the performing arts. She was a part of it all. It was amazing. She did the stand-up comedy thing. It was just amazing.
She did.
I didn't have the privilege of seeing that.
She just did a little bit of everything. It was amazing. And you know, she came down to my shop, and she would make sculptures and stuff, and she did paper, and she did glass, and she painted. One step beyond that, it wasn't just in the arts. I mean, I was on the board of the community table with her. She was a mm-hmm. very staunch women's rights activist. I mean, it's just so incredible to look at. She was not one-dimensional.
What I meant by, at the beginning of that particular question, an arts community can, to people outside of it, if there is an outside of it, appear elitist and you can't come in and blah, blah, blah. But she was an ambassador for knocking down those kinds of fences, because art needs to be appealing to, you know, all artistic preferences. I've always thought a real great work of art was its ability to wow people everywhere.
Going back to kind of what I was talking before is when a person... whether a musician, writer, speaker, visual artist, you have to learn the techniques of what you're about before you can have a voice. Mm-hmm. And once you have that voice, your techniques and your abilities are like knowing language. You don't have to think about them anymore. So it moves into another area where you use your technique to speak. It becomes your new voice. And, you know, everybody has that. They just don't a lot of times want to be that committal. And I think mm-hmm. being an artist, you really have to kind of show stuff that most people are afraid to show.
Yeah,
Laurie was always invaluable about educating people about art. And the more you appreciate or the more you are educated about art or in just about any other subject, the more you can appreciate it. And this community owes a lot to Laurie in her getting work out there, having galleries, starting like the Banbury Art Crawl. I mean, the list goes on. And educational factor was just totally invaluable.
I worked in banking for 35 years, and when I retired...
That's artistic in a way, too.
No, it's not. But when I retired...
There's creative financing.
Well, there is, and I worked on that end.
Okay.
But when I retired, I said, I get to now do what my passion is. And Lori Beasy was the inspiration for me to embrace the arts. And now I get to do what I love to do. And I'm not an artist, but I'm on the board of the State Theater, mm-hmm. and I worked on the Banbury Art Crawl. I love the artistic people. Our friends are the artistic people, and we surround ourselves with them. And a lot of it is because of the inspiration that Lori Beasy gave us. So she has really a lot of input into the directions that we've taken in our lives.
Well, see, I would beg to differ with you on that, and that is that, you know, I think people who facilitate artists and help them get their work out and inspire them from a different angle are also artistic in their own right.
My husband would say the same, but
well, good for
I can only draw
important.
Stick figures.
They're just as important.
Absolutely.
As David said earlier, we could talk for a long time. We could probably dedicate the whole show to the life and times of Lori Beasy, but let's end it with what you guys think individually her legacy will be.
There's really no one legacy. This whole town is filled with her art. She's inspired like countless amounts of people. It's just too grand to even try to evaluate.
I think her smile. I talked to her daughter.
Yeah. That's totally right. Positive.
She had that original photograph hanging right above the toilet in her little tiny bathroom.
She did.
And every time I would go in there...
The one that appeared on the obituary? Yep.
That's right. Yeah. And I thought to myself, someday I want to ask Lori if I can have a copy of that. Well, unfortunately, I didn't ask her. I ended up having to ask her daughter.
Okay.
And I would have taken the photograph from the photograph. Mm-hmm. But she knew there were other people who wanted them, too. And so she had a lot of them printed. And I think her smile is going to be her legacy.
A lot of people must have seen that photograph if they saw it in the newspaper. Any idea what this was a reaction to?
David Stanton took the photograph, and it was, I don't remember a lot of the details of it, but David Stanton was a photographer in town, and he also played music, and he was always really good at making Lori laugh really hard, because he was kind of quite the character, and I thought it was caught, like, in a very spontaneous moment. That's definitely not a sort of contrived photograph. That's really Lori.
Absolutely, yeah.
She was extremely optimistic.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, the arts, I know, it's just like I get kind of pessimistic sometimes about, like, the art in the Midwest and stuff, but Lori just, it just never fazed her. She was always positive.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
I just found her to be one of the most amazing people I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
And her positive attitude is totally what I have always tried to embrace as well. And she was the leader of the band.
Was she able to maintain that positive attitude right up to
right
the
up
end?
To the end.
Classy. Classy.
Right up to the end.
Absolutely classy. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Absolutely classy.
We were in her living room, a month or two ago. No, it was in April, because it was right before the yes-no referendum.
Okay.
And she wanted us to bring her yes-no sign for her front yard.
Uh-huh.
And we were sitting talking about the excitement of the confluence and the building of the downtown area and the future of it. And she just yelled an expletive. And we all stopped and said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "I won't be here to see that."
Uh-huh.
You know?
Mm.
But she was positive right up to the end. Huh. Worked on behalf of it right up to the end.
Unbelievable.
I'm sure all of you feel, you know, it would be awfully fitting to have something, an exhibit, an event, something named after her. Is that something people you think are going to undertake?
Absolutely.
When we get over the grieving, we'll start thinking of something.
I certainly hope so, yeah.
Yeah, there's going to be a citywide, more than likely a citywide celebration of her life at the end of September. There's a lot of planning that's going to be involved in that. That's why the time going to pass. But, yes, I'm sure there will be things, or at least a major event, if not numerous things, that will be named after her.
Well, thanks so much for being with us here on Spectrum West. I appreciate it. Having known her as well as you do, please accept our condolences.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Laurie Beasy was also an arts segment contributor in the early days of Spectrum West and even preceded the program by supplying independent reports on the state of the arts in this part of Wisconsin. Thanks to Mel and Sally Sundby, David Caradori, Joe Ellenberg, and others who helped this verbal celebration along. The celebration of Laurie's life, the party, will be in September. Coming to the State Theater in Eau Claire Sunday evening at 7:30, it's the music of Gillian Welch and Dave. Here's a taste for you.
Becky Johnson bought the farm, put a needle in her arm. That's the way that it goes, that's the way. And her brother laid her down in the cold Kentucky ground. That's the way that it goes, that's the way. That's the way. It goes. Everybody's buying little baby clothes. That's the way that it ends. Though there was a time when she and I were friends. And Miranda ran away, took a cat and left L.A. That's the way that it goes. That's the way. Was busted, broken, flat, and had to sell that pussy cat. That's the way that it goes. That's the way. That's the way that it goes. Everybody's buying little baby clothes. That's the way that it ends. Though there was a time. Brightest ones of all, early in October fall. That's the way that it goes, that's the way. While the dark ones go to bed with good whiskey in their heads. That's the way.
That's the cool music of Gillian Welch. She'll be here with Dave at the State Theater Sunday night, 7:30. Tickets at 832-ARTS and online at eauclairearts.com. That's good stuff.
Support for WPR comes from the National Eagle Center in Wabasha, Minnesota, now featuring daily live eagle programs and the new exhibit, Masters of the Sky, Raptors Flight and Migration. More information and details at nationaleaglecenter.org.
Spectrum West, nice to be with you today. Spectrum Memo, hear the incomparable sound of Metro Brass from the Twin Cities Sunday evening at 7 in the Darrell Aderman Auditorium at the Shell Lake Arts Center. It's a free concert. The Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls has opened a new exhibit called 9 Local Photographers. It'll be up through August 22nd. The artist's reception is coming in July on the 25th. Details by phone at 726-9000 or online at cvca.net. In the Janet Carson Gallery at the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center, it's the high school art show. It will be up through August 1st. There's an artist reception this evening, Thursday, 5 p.m. EauClaireArts.com, that's the address again. Tuesday Night Blues at Owen Park in Eau Claire, July 8th. It's the Dave Rogers Band. Music starts at 6:30. Thursday night, tonight, July 3rd, the Sounds Like Summer Concert Series at Phoenix Park. Eau Claire presents A Bug Adventure, The Long Shots, and Hannah Hebel. From Eau Claire, UW Eau Claire, next Monday at Owen Park, music by the Cactus Blossoms. And Wednesday, catch the movie Dr. Strangelove on the lawn west of the Haas Fine Arts Center. Chill on the Hill at UW River Falls continues Tuesday, July 8th, featuring Robert Everest. He's a world music guy. Thursday night, tonight, July 3rd, if you're listening on Thursday, at Memorial Park in Ladysmith, the Music in the Park series presents Danville, and it's sponsored by the Flambeau Valley Arts Association. The Old Gem Theater in New Richmond has two sessions of summer theater camp for young people. The Little Mermaid session starts Monday, but the Peter Pan camp runs July 28th through August
16th. Classes meet Monday through Thursday from 5 to 8 p.m. Details at oldgemtheater.com. Well, universities, especially those within the UW system, are known for their diversity. At least in a few areas, of course. Filmmaking is an assigned academic challenge. The big stage is available more and more to people learning their craft. The LGBTQ campus communities have a strong voice in areas of study, take students toward wide new horizons. Some UW-Eau Claire students took on the task of producing a short-form documentary film that took them to San Francisco and back, then returning to show their work at the prestigious Frameline Film Festival. The film is Housing First. It documents the plight of the gay population, especially AIDS victims, and securing and keeping adequate housing in the face of changes within the city by the Bay. J.R. Smathers, a liberal studies major from Altoona, was one of the producers of the film, and he spoke with us via telephone from Madison. I did read that you received support in the form of at least a couple grants with which to produce the film. Talk a bit about the process used to get that project rolling. Were you going to do a film anyway and you were looking for a topic, or was this the topic right from the beginning?
Well, probably about April of last year was when we really started going with the course we were part of, and one of the requirements of the course is to make a film.
Okay.
The professors assign you a topic, and then you take that topic and run with it. We actually started with a different but similar theme. We tried to reach out to this organization we were going to do our project on, and we just didn't get any responses. And then by the time we got there, like, we still hadn't heard from them, but we had contacted some other, like, similar organizations. And then we found the AIDS Housing Coalition, or AIDS Housing Alliance. They were very helpful, and we had our first interview with them, and then we kind of decided from that interview to forgo our first idea, but to take this housing situation in San Francisco and turn that into our movie.
It's interesting that the mentors in that particular class, I mean, I'm impressed that they pick topics that take you to the hinterland. I mean, they could easily pick something in Wisconsin, for instance, but they say, no, you guys got to go out and feel your oats a little bit. So that's pretty cool, and it's good for your experience.
Yeah, just being, like, outside of Wisconsin even, it's completely different, really different cultures out there.
Tell me more about, let's backtrack a bit back to the festival you were just at. Tell me more about that festival at which the piece played. It appears as if it's significant to have been chosen.
Yes, so, let's see, we were just at Frameline 38, which is the world's largest LGBTQ film festival.
Ah.
And we were selected to be part of the Homegrown series. So the professors have done this class for 4 years now, and every year they have managed to get something from the class into the film festival. And they were extremely excited to hear that we were in kind of the mid-sized theater.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, students' work and their own work has been in the smallest of the theaters that are part of the film festival. We were kind of the odd ones out because everything else in the series was made by people from the Bay Area. The whole series of short films we were part of, it was kind of a local interest thing. So that's why we were chosen to be part of it.
Here you guys come in from Wisconsin, for gosh sakes. Did they say, way to go? You were welcomed well?
Everybody was really welcoming to us, and they were, they were, like, people in the audience who saw our film were quite excited about it. Like, you could feel the audience reaction to some of the content of our film, and that they were kind of passionate about these things that we talked about, and they were very excited to hear these things delivered to them.
J.R. Smathers on the phone with us. He's an Altoona native. We're talking to him from Madison. He's one of the producers of the documentary short Housing First. It's a 22-minute piece about the vital role that housing plays in the San Francisco LGBT community, which is deemed a hot-button issue at this moment. From what you've told me, the courses that you're taking, it appears as if you're looking at a career as a filmmaker.
I'm kind of leaning towards trying to get some sort of career in filmmaking, whether it's making more documentaries. Maybe I've been really wanting to do something more with a narrative film where I kind of have control of the entire situation and less about capturing the moment as it is, but more about more of that creative control with it.
Are you looking to have a career in socially conscious films, or are you going to get into entertainment, or what appeals to you most?
Overall, entertainment appeals to me most, okay. But I think it's always important to include some of those more social messages with what you're trying to convey.
Let's go back to the details about the production. How long did it take? Because it goes from pre-production, it took how long to shoot, it took a lot of time to edit. What was the timeline for the entire project?
We got started in about April of last year, and that was kind of a couple meetings before the class actually started. So that was kind of our research period. So we spent a couple months research, then the class actually started, which kind of assisted with us getting more familiar with the LGBT community and things that happen in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Then about halfway through the summer, we fly out to San Francisco. We attended the film festival, and then we had 2 weeks there to record everything for our movie.
Okay.
Then after the film festival is over, we end up flying back home, and then we have about a month to sit down and edit our movie, and that's a couple long days. It's about 9 to 4 every single day of the week for the entire month of July.
So while you were there, did you immerse yourself in that community? Is that where you stayed?
Yes, we were in the Castro District, which is essentially the LGBTQ center for San Francisco. And then we attended Frameline and some of the other LGBT events in the city, including the Pride Parade and then the Pink Saturday events.
From watching the film, though, it appears as if San Francisco and the Castro especially is changing somewhat, or people are being forced to change.
It seems to be the case that the tech companies, as they are, they're building up in these large cities, and that's attracting more tech workers. It's just kind of an unfortunate side effect that as these tech workers are moving in, they're getting the higher wages, and then the higher wages are raising rents for everybody else who really can't afford those.
Yeah. It appears to me as if there's also a very robust LGBTQ community circle at UW Eau Claire. I mean, they have a festival, the Eau Queer Festival. That's a film festival too, isn't it?
Yes, that is a film festival.
They seem to be very supportive. Well, that's a good question. How supportive have they been about the project that you undertook?
Well, the Eau Queer Film Festival is sort of associated with the class. When the class is done as a full, it is typically that the students who go to make the movies also view films at the Frameline Film Festival and pick movies that are shown there, which would be a good fit for the Eau Claire audience. And then we try to bring those movies back to Eau Claire and show them in our festival.
The Eau Queer Film Festival is coming in September. Are you planning on participating with the current film? Or are you going to do a new film? Or what's planned for this year?
Well, our film did show last year in the film festival,
and
I'm currently on staff with the film festival as like a film festival trailer production. So we're currently working on writing and then filming a short, like, 2-minute trailer to help promote the film festival.
Well, keep us posted about it. Congratulations on the exposure that your film received. Tell me what's next for you. What's on the horizon? What are you working on?
Right now, I'm just really working on finishing up with classes. I'm looking to graduate next summer. So once that's finished, we'll see what comes from there. As far as film projects, don't really have anything too big planned. I have a couple friends down in Madison who are planning on collaborating and trying to come up with some short film idea.
Mm-hmm. The thing that you find out when you do documentaries is that you learn things that you did not know. Was that the case with producing Housing First? And if so, did you feel yourself wanting to become an activist of sorts on their behalf?
Definitely. I mean, I feel like living so far away from San Francisco, it's like, you know, these aren't really things you hear about. And then just being immersed in that culture and then, you know, seeing how passionate some of these people were getting about these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what they're willing to do to get the message out and to, you know, help the city that they love. It's very powerful.
J.R. Smathers, congratulations again, and thanks so much for being with us here on Spectrum West.
Thank you.
Exciting stuff for a young filmmaker. Great experience with encouragement from the men and women who provide the education and support. Again, the Oh Queer Film Festival at UWEC is in its fifth year. It's September 24th through 28th. And the film schedule will be posted by mid-August at the website.
Here's what's on stage in area theater venues. In the Great River Shakespeare Festival in Winona, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead will play tonight, Thursday, Saturday evening, and Wednesday afternoon. Merry Wives of Windsor will play Friday, Sunday, and Tuesday. Hamlet will play Saturday afternoon. That Love and Feelin', the story of the Righteous Brothers, will play Friday and Saturday at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show will play Fridays and Saturdays and selected Sundays through August 9th. Auditions for Agatha Christie's A Murder is Announced will be held from 6 to 9 p.m. Tuesday and Wednesday at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Yes, you are. Thank you, sir. Spectrum Memo Writers Read summer sessions are scheduled for July 8th and August 12th at the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. Also at the library, another summer of the adult reading program Wheel of Reading through August 4th. It involves reading, spinning to win, and more. Information is at ecpubliclibrary.info. At the Art Z Gallery in Amory, July features quilt artist Carol Fuhrer. Sorry if I butchered it. Painter Paul Oman, basket artist Phyllis Knutson. There will be an artist reception next Friday, the 11th, from 5 to 8 p.m. The exhibition will be up through July 31st. Info at artzgallery.org. That puts a ribbon around Spectrum West for this week. How much fun was that? Wow. Good stuff. Next week, a UW Stout student self-published a book about never having a boyfriend. We hope to be talking about that. There is a kitchen you can use at the Eau Claire County Expo. We will be talking about that. And we'll resume our conversation about how Wisconsinites talk. Plus more. Always more. Hey, enjoy the holiday weekend, everybody. Drive well. And we'll see you again tomorrow night, Friday night at 7 on the News and Classical Music Network for a repeat of this week's show. And again, next Thursday live on the Ideas Network. I'm Al Ross. See ya.